If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
There's no better feeling than a personal win, and the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
And welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today we're going to be talking about werewolves, and in particular, their presence in the myths and legends of the ancient world. Werewolves are, of course, one of the mainstays of horror fiction in the modern day. But you might be surprised to learn just how far back the creature's origins stretch. Professor Daniel Ogden of Exeter University has just written a book on the ancient werewolf, and he was joined in conversation by BBC History Magazine editor Rob Attar.
Daniel, in the introduction to your book, you write that if a jobbing classicist were to compile a list of good ancient werewolf stories, there would essentially only be one. And I realise you go on to challenge that notion within the book, but as a way into this story, I wonder if you could summarise that story by Petronius.
Well, the story is told by a nouveau riche and rather tasteless freedman, former slave, at a dinner party of a group of similar people, part of Petronius's dinner of Trimalchio. And Nicaros tells the story about when he was previously a slave. He had a girlfriend. This is somewhere in Campania, in southern Italy. He had a girlfriend who obviously lived a certain number of miles away. We're not really given details about the locations. And he decided to go and visit her one night. A soldier was lodging with his master and agreed to come along for the journey. So there they were proceeding down the road, and it was one of those roads that the Romans used to have lined with tombs. And at a certain point, the soldier stops. Initially, it seems to take a pee against one of the tombstones, and our narrator Nicaros suddenly realizes that he's taken all his clothes off and made them into a little pile. He's peed around them in a circle and turned into a wolf and run off. He goes to the clothes and finds that they've been magically turned to stone. He's terrified. He imagines himself to be surrounded by ghosts on all sides. Anyway, but he makes his way over to his girlfriend's house, which is both a pub and a farm, it seems, rather oddly, and she tells him that she wished he'd come earlier because a wolf had just got in and was butchering the sheep. But one of their own slaves had managed to drive a spear through its neck, and that had seen it off. The next morning, he returns home terrified. When he gets to the point in amongst the tombstones where the clothes had been, the clothes have gone, but there's blood. And when he finally makes it home, he finds the soldier in bed with a doctor tending his neck wound. And he realizes, only at that stage, surprisingly, he realizes that the soldier is a werewolf, and he refuses ever to break bread with him again.
Okay, so this is a really, really powerful, really, almost sounds quite a modern story of a werewolf, actually. So
very modern, yes.
And I guess our listeners' understanding of werewolf legends probably only really go back, well, they may be modern, but probably only go back as far as perhaps the medieval era. So is what you're doing in this book quite revelatory, actually, that you're taking the werewolf story a lot further back than people probably understand them to go?
Yes, well, I suppose, you know, people familiar with classical literature will be aware of this particular werewolf story. Again, Petronius is one of the major Latin authors. I don't suppose it has much of a breakout factor beyond, as it were, the classics realm. Yeah, the point is rather this. We hear about werewolves in scattered sources from the ancient world up until Augustine, around about 400 AD. And from that point on, there's pretty much silence until the 12th century. And then in the 12th century, particularly in French and Anglo-French, and actually also in Norse literature, werewolves just burst out at us all over. And from that point on, it's been a continuous tradition until today. So the question is, what's going on in those 800 years, as it were, well, 700 years of silence? Now, there are two possible answers to that. With the French and Anglo-French literature, one could say, well, these chaps are just reading Petronius, and they're bringing that stuff to life again and reincorporating the werewolf story into their own culture, into their own times. That doesn't really work for the Norse werewolf, however. But it does seem to me that if you look very carefully at the incidental details in the Petronius story and some other ancient werewolf stories, on the other hand, in the medieval stories, you can see that what we have here is not the medieval writers going back and sort of borrowing the werewolf in a sort of very literate fashion. Rather, what we have is a continuous tradition of folklore. And this is popping up, up into higher literature in the ancient world, and then going underground for 700 years, and then popping back up again in the medieval period. And so I think that's fascinating. So there is this continuity, this secret underground continuity. And I think that is quite an important thing to be able to establish.
So beyond Petronius, what do you see as the other really important ancient texts for giving us this idea of werewolves?
Well, Herodotus is talking about a Scythian people, kind of Russian people called the Nuri, who are said to be sorcerers and change themselves into wolves every so often. He doesn't give any more context, unfortunately, but the idea is well established there already in this classical Greek historian, 5th century. We have a lot of werewolves in a lot of glancing references, I should say, to werewolves in the main Latin poets of the so-called Golden Age and Silver Age. So basically the first century AD poets, the familiar people, Virgil, Ovid, people like that, Propertius. We have a great story in the Pausanias, who wrote the Guide to Greece in the 2nd century AD. We have the story of the hero of Temesa, who is described as a sort of ghost in a wolf skin. We have a nice story in Aesop about a thief who pretends to be a werewolf in order to frighten people away from their stuff so that she can steal it. We also have in Pliny the Elder, so about the middle of the 1st century AD, we have a nice story about an athlete, a great Olympic victor who, before that, had spent a period of time as a werewolf. So I think that gives you a selection. There are many other texts we could point to, and I mentioned Augustine, of course, at the end of that tradition.
And through these texts, are there any common features we can see, or do they all describe these creatures quite differently?
There is a great deal of diversity, but there are some common features indeed. I think the single most striking one is, you might say, the phrase, into the woods. Almost universally, when a werewolf is, when a man changes himself into a wolf or is changed into a wolf, we're told, and he ran off into the woods. Occasionally, it's the other way around. He ran off into the woods and became a wolf. So, and that has a, of course, that has a very striking contemporary resonance. And you may be familiar with the Stephen Sondheim musical, pulling together stuff from the, I think it's from the Grimm's tales, isn't it? But anyway, certainly good folk tale, fairy tale stuff. And that is actually entitled Into the Woods. That's a very common recurring theme. And that actually is, it seems that little phrase highlights perhaps the key point about the ancient werewolf. It's not a creature full of meaning, really. I'd say it was a form rather than a meaning, a form onto which meanings can be imposed. But one thing that is fairly constant is that opposition, that confrontation, that transition between the civilized world of man and the wild world of the animals or the woods. So that sort of seems to be sort of inherent to the concept. There are other themes as well, and I suppose the next thing I would point to is the theme of the inside and the outside. The idea is that a werewolf is one creature inside another. Often it's basically, and I think usually, it's a wolf inside a man. And so the werewolf's sort of outer carapace is human form, but that human form is also rather confusingly identified with his clothing. But then that does sort of make sense, because the clothing is, as it were, you know, as it were, you might say, what distinguishes a man from an animal. The symbol of a man's civilization. When a werewolf takes his clothes off, as in the Petronius story that I summarised, he takes off his outer human form, and the wolf, as it were, is released from within. But I say there are other ways of thinking about it, and when I also referred in passing to Pausanias's story of the hero of Temesa, and that werewolf is described as a ghost in a wolf skin. So, for what's left of the human form, the ghost is on the inside, and the wolf is on the outside. In that context, one can think about inside and outside in other ways as well. In some contexts, people are imagined to become wolves through cannibalism, as it were. So you take the human flesh inside you, which is what a wolf should do. You become a wolf. But and conversely, also werewolves in wolf form can become humans by eating wolf parts, strangely. So that notion of the inside and the outside is played about with quite a lot in ancient literature.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
So I think, strangely, werewolves are wolves because wolves themselves are, in a sense, already werewolves. They themselves already embody those two qualities of the wildness and civilizedness.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it, so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night,
Feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Do we have a sense of why wolves in particular? I mean, I guess there were other legends of shapeshifting to other animals. What did the transformation to a wolf specifically say?
Well, this is a question, of course, that's bigger than classical antiquity, just as the werewolf is bigger than classical antiquity. In classical antiquity itself, you're right. I mean, anybody who's familiar with Ovid's Metamorphoses, of course, will know that people are changing to all sorts of creatures, all sorts of plants even, all over the place in Greek myth. But nonetheless, outside that particular realm, when we move more into sort of what you might call a sort of a folkloric area, the wolf does seem to be, as it were, the animal of choice for transformation, as in other cultures. I would have two things to say about this, maybe three. The wolf is a useful animal simply because it does easily convey, as it were, that wildness and savageness, that opposite pole to civilization. And so that's a good reason for choosing, as it were, a wolf to be the animal of the animal of transformation. Another reason is that I suppose that, I mean, there are loads of, you know, very wild, very savage creatures out there. Another reason is perhaps that wolves are roughly ballpark sort of human sized, or at least, you know, one can imagine a sort of an easy transition between a wolf body and a human body in terms of size. I mean, the other creature that sort of gets focused upon again in the wider European tradition for transformation is the bear. I mentioned Norse culture briefly. Alongside werewolves in Norse culture, you also get werebears. And again, I would say, you know, that again, there's something sort of human in size and indeed even in sort of, you might say, configuration about a bear. So that I think that is significant. However, to go back to wolves, I think actually, paradoxically, although the wildness is so important in choosing the animal, I think wolves are chosen also because they in themselves strangely embody these two qualities of the wildness, the savagery, but also the civilization. Because again, I'm sure we've all seen the documentaries now about wolf packs, and these are very ordered, very cooperative, very collaborative societies. And the ancients, by the way, were aware of that too. It's important to note. And of course, it's the sort of a wolf's ability to collaborate and cooperate and be part of a community that, of course, that allowed the wolf to give us the dog, which we integrate into our own community. So I think, strangely, werewolves are wolves because wolves themselves are, in a sense, already werewolves. They themselves already embody those two qualities of the wildness and civilizedness.
And is there any relevance to the fact that there are quite a lot of other ancient myths involving wolves, not necessarily shape-shifting wolves, you know, something like Romulus and Remus? Does that figure into this at all?
I'm going to say it depends on the myth, really. I don't think that the Romulus and Remus myth is part of the story of the werewolves. But I suppose you could say that in the figure of the mother wolf there, you do have those two qualities again. As it were, the twins are sort of cast out into the wilderness, into ultimate peril, into the world of wildness, hence the wolf comes along. But of course, she is a very tame, civilized, nurturing wolf. So I suppose we do get those two ideas woven together there in that myth as well. I suppose that there are other myths of involving wolves which are more tightly involved with werewolves or akin to werewolves. So we have the myth of Lycaon, who starts off being a man and is transformed into a wolf by Zeus because he tries to feed him human flesh in a sacrifice. And people have said, well, you know, just because he's turned into a wolf in a one-off act like that, that doesn't make him a werewolf. And, well, maybe that's right. But certainly the ideas of, as it were, civilization and wildness, and, of course, cannibalism, are in play there. And the myth of Lycaon, whether or not he's a werewolf in himself, is actually tied in with ideas of werewolfism, because the Lycaon myth is a sort of like the foundation myth for a complex of cults that took place on Mount Lycaon in Arcadia, and the notion of werewolfism was strongly integrated into those cults, because at the big sacrifice every year, some young men would take their clothes off, hang them on a tree, swim across a pond, and be transformed into wolves and live as wolves for a certain period of time. And if they didn't eat anybody during their times as wolves, they would return eventually back across the pond, recover their clothes from the tree, and become human again. So that's a nice sort of cultic expression of werewolfism. And again, of course, the clothes are identified with the human carapace. And when they're removed, as it were, the wolf within is released there.
So I guess nowadays, in terms of literature, film, TV, the werewolf is in the same kind of sphere as things like vampires, ghosts, witches, demons. Was that the case then? In the ancient world, did these creatures also inhabit this same kind of world?
That's a really good question. And there's several ways to approach it. As I've mentioned, I think, already, the werewolf is above all a creature of folklore. So we can imagine, I think, that the context in which werewolf stories were typically told were sort of like, you know, campfire horror story contexts. We started with Petronius. The tale that's told at the dinner party by Nikaros, the werewolf story there, is told as part of a sort of a competitive pair of stories, with a story told by Trimalchio himself. And that's a story about, you could call them sort of vampire witches, Striges, Strix witch. And these witches were told, and this is a wonderful story too, we're told about how we have a house, a baby boy in the house has died and is sort of laid out ready for burial the next day. But the witches attack and they trick their way into the house invisibly, it seems. They have that ability and they are able to sort of steal and devour the baby's body. It's a wonderful story, rather better than I've told it, to be honest. So just from that pair of stories alone, we get the sense that the werewolf stories exist in a world of stories of that sort. Now, you mentioned vampires. That's one of the big questions, really, is to what extent the ancient world had a concept of a vampire. So in some ways, the Strix witch is the closest, perhaps, to a vampire. But I have mentioned already that we have living werewolves, but we also have dead werewolves. Dead people can manifest themselves as wolves. So I mentioned the hero of Temesa. This chap seemingly is given an annual tribute and comes along and devours a virgin girl from the city of Temesa every year. So he's kind of vampirish, I suppose, that he's dead and he's a werewolf and he eats people. It's really a sort of medieval development in the Balkans, this notion of the Vrikola Kas, who's a sort of a staple of Serbian culture and Greek culture, Bulgarian culture, I think, so really all that area. And the Vrikola Kas is basically variously conceptualised either as a werewolf or as a vampire. It's sort of one thing but both things at the same time. I think that's really the point at which, as it were, those two concepts get melded together for us. So yes, yeah, so again, to leap forward a long way. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with the Underworld movies of recent years, but and these movies construct quite an interesting mythos, actually, where you have basically, you know, the vampires on the one side and the werewolves on the other, a sort of equal and opposite peoples who are sort of in some sort of constant war with each other. That's a nice idea, which does actually, which some people might find odd when first encountering it, but actually in many ways really does pay tribute to this, as it were, the deep mythology and traditions of werewolves and vampires there.
Now, are there any instances in the ancient world of werewolves not being a negative force, but actually being either an ambivalent or a positive creature?
In the ancient world, I'm struggling. No, can't call to mind a clear example of that. I think we have to wait for the, as it were, the medieval stuff, and indeed the earliest medieval stuff, to get that. So again, I mean, the most famous early medieval werewolf would be Bisclavre in the lay of that name by Marie de France. Again, he's a good guy who is turned into a werewolf and lives as a very honourable wolf. He is a werewolf by nature. It's not explained why, and he has to run off into the woods every so often and become a wolf. There's that concept again. And when his wife finds out about this, she's horrified. And she learns that he takes his clothes off. Here we are again, this same imagery. Hides them under a stone and then becomes a wolf for a few days and then recovers them and comes back to the human world. But his wife, with her lover, having learned this, steals his clothes and so leaves him trapped as a wolf. And so he lives in this way for many years. Actually, happens upon a benign king and becomes the treasured pet, the valued pet of the king. And then his former wife turns up at court, now married to her lover, he attacks her. And when the king investigates the context of all this, all is revealed. And eventually, Bisclavaret's clothes are returned to him, and he recovers his human form.
Now, was there any connection at this stage between the condition known as lycanthropy and werewolves?
Right. Well, today we use lycanthropy just as a posh word for werewolfism, I suppose. The word is an ancient Greek word, leucanthropia, which means wolf humanism, I suppose, in its elements. But in the ancient world, this term is confined to a supposed medical condition, and the way people suffering from lycanthropy are described is that they're described as becoming listless, rolling around amongst tombs in cemeteries. Again, that tomb connection, that ghostly connection. There doesn't seem to be anything about physical transformation or growing hair. And it's rather curious as to why the wolf imagery should be applied to them. That ghostly connection aside, but there we are. So that's ancient lycanthropy. And again, there's a very strong tradition in the ancient medical writers, Greek and Latin, about that. The word lycanthropy and lycanthrope, like leucanthropos, that only comes to be applied to what we would call real werewolves in the Byzantine period, mid-central Byzantine period. Yeah.
Finally, do you think it's time that these ancient werewolves were introduced more into popular culture? Should the next big werewolf movie be set in ancient Rome or something?
Well, there's no reason it shouldn't be, is there? Yes, sorry, I don't know if I have a lot to say about that. I mean, yes, the Petronius story is great, but it's quite a short story. You'd need a lot of fleshing out. But yes, why not? I mean, the ancient world is always a great context. Well, for narratives of any kind, isn't it?
That was Professor Daniel Ogden. His book, The Werewolf in the Ancient World, is out now, published by Oxford University Press. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tomorrow, Peter Stottard will be talking about the assassins of Julius Caesar.